great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Almost year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, and of course, the virus is still spreading. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services says as of Tuesday, there are nearly 6,000 new COVID cases, and for weeks, every Wisconsin county has listed its case level as critically high. We have Dr. Nasia Safdar with us as well, with us now. She's a professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She's a member of an infection control department at UW Health. So great to have her with us to talk more about this Omicron variant. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. What questions do you have about it? Do you have concerns about maybe having your child vaccinated? Maybe yourself. Call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Nasia Safdar, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
There's a new version of the Omicron variant. It's called Stealth Variant, and it's been detected in 40 countries, including the U.S. What do we know about this new version?
You know, I think very little at this point, other than the fact that it's been detected, which is a testament to the, you know, programs that detect these new variants. You know, certainly whenever there's a major variant of concern, I think everyone does need to sit up and take notice. But I think after some time, this will become, you know, part of how this virus evolves, that there will be something or the other that's circulating. And I tend to not focus so much on what's the latest new variant that's emerging, unless we have evidence that it's, you know, fundamentally different from what's going on now.
Yeah. So people should be, what, concerned?
No, I don't think at this point people should be concerned, other than, you know, sort of this baseline feeling of having been under siege by this virus now for, this is year three into it. You know, from my perspective, and of course people will have their own ideas about how they handle uncertainty, but to keep a sense of perspective on all of this, I tend to focus on the things that we have available to protect us and not so much on, you know, what's around the corner that we really cannot predict even.
How easily can this Omicron, I mean, it sounds like it can easily spread from person to person versus other variants.
Yes, I think the key signature of Omicron is that it is very transmissible. And knowing that that is the case, then it makes it difficult for people to think that they can completely avoid it. You know, it's the way that it's spreading, it seems you will encounter it at some point.
And I know the FDA, here's another thing. The FDA has authorized the use of antiviral pills to treat people who have tested positive for COVID-19. One pill was developed by Pfizer. I think the other Merck did. How do those pills work?
Well, so these are, you know, the first direct antivirals that we have, and they work well. But of course, from the perspective of public health, you know, anytime that you can prevent something from happening, that is always better if you can move more upstream. Because even though it's true that many people with Omicron will have mild symptoms and will recover quickly, but, you know, there's all kinds of silent things that can be happening in the body that may be more or less predominant depending upon one's immune system and one's age and one's other illnesses. So the preference is always, you know, if you can prevent something, that is the number one strategy. Having said that, it's not always the case that you can prevent something, because nothing's 100% preventable. So then these antivirals come into play as an added treatment.
Yeah. Let's take a call. Steve in Wausau will give you a chance. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure if this will be on point or not, but several years ago, before the coronavirus started, there was an Ebola breakout in, I think, the northwest part of the country, Seattle or something like that, and they stopped it, or they nipped it right away, and I wondered how they did that. What did they do different in that particular outbreak?
Hmm.
Well, so I think that, you know, there are some fundamental commonalities among communicable diseases that spread from person to person, and then there are some fundamental differences. And the way that something can be contained really depends entirely upon how it spreads. You know, Ebola is not spread through airborne route the way that SARS-CoV-2 is. Ebola is not spread by people, just talking to each other in closed environments, for instance, the way this Omicron in particular does. And so it was a bit easier to contain than this one. But having said that, you know, the fundamental things about distancing, masking, PPE, all those things apply to many communicable illnesses.
Steve, thank you very much for calling in. Charlie in Milwaukee will give you a chance to join in. Hi.
Hi, yes. Hi. Yes, this is Charlie from Milwaukee. Hi, Larry. I was just calling because I am a very pro-science person. I have an 11-year-old boy who wants to get boosted as soon as possible. I am all three shots, boosted and all that. So is my wife. But I was calling because I was wondering what, after you have the vaccine in your body, how long do you think the effectiveness, you know, what's the efficacy period from preventing you from going into the hospital or even worse, death? And then secondly, are we going to have like seasonal vaccines or boosters like the flu, because COVID is just not going to go away and there's going to be variants all the time, or are we going to see an end to the boosters and vaccinations at one point? Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling. Dr. Safdar?
Yeah. So I think in terms of, you know, the vaccine effectiveness, I think in terms of preventing complications like hospitalization or death, the vaccine effectiveness, regardless of which one you get, is very high, in the order of 70% plus. Even if that decays over time, it still remains very, very good compared to, you know, many other things that we have available for prevention. Now, there are two ways to detect vaccine effectiveness. One is to take a blood test to look at detectable antibodies, and the other is the T cell arm of the immune system, which is not as easy to detect, but nonetheless does a great deal of work to protect the body once you have the vaccine. So most of our studies are based on the easy-to-measure thing, which is the antibody, which we know decays a little bit over time, hence the recommendation for a booster. But the whole T-cell arm of things is also likely to be very protective. So I think we're probably underestimating how long these vaccines are effective, and they're likely to be effective for longer than we think they are at the moment based on the measurements that are being done.
Yeah.
And in terms of, you know, what that means then for the future, I think there will be a great deal of advancement in the way that we think about vaccines. I mean, people are talking about research into a universal coronavirus vaccine that covers a lot of the known and potentially, you know, evolving variants. There's also talk about combining different vaccines together. So this field is likely to evolve considerably by next year, such that what we're doing now is this is really the first generation of vaccines, and it's going to look very different, I think, in the future.
Yeah.
Even though the technology will likely be the same.
Interesting. Mona in Appleton, on to you. Hi, Mona.
Hi. I just had a question. I guess it's ethics, because a friend of mine whose husband is 100% against vaccines, the wife is vaccinated, they have two children that are of age that can get vaccinated, so he forbade her to get the vaccine. So she said, we'll see what the doctor says, which is a great way to deal with it. The doctor just more or less backed the anti-vaccine. He said that the risk of this thing with the heart that kids might get, he didn't recommend them getting the vaccine. And then I heard from another friend who was just really sick. She's just getting over it. And her doctor, a different doctor, different area of Wisconsin, told her that, oh, now she's protected because she's got the antibodies. It wasn't like it was in the beginning where they said, yeah, you should get it, but wait so many weeks or months before you get the shot. So I'm just kind of wondering how...
Should kids get the shot? In other words, you're saying, for the most part. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things going on there, Dr. Safdar, but you want to comment?
Well, I think it's definitely tricky because, you know, everyone is prone to misinformation and taking that misinformation and accepting it as real. I think you will find that the vast majority of people, and the ones that you mentioned seem like exceptions,
But the vast majority of providers will say that the game changer in this pandemic is the vaccine for everyone that is eligible to get it, and that includes children. Now, of course, if you think about it from the trade-off perspective, yes, there's a very tiny chance of getting what is called myocarditis from the vaccine, but that is lower than the chance of getting myocarditis from COVID-19 itself, and it is far lower than the risk of getting sick and needing hospitalization and feeling ill for weeks on end from the disease. So, you know, as vaccines go, these are very safe, highly effective vaccines. And then in terms of, you know, if you've had COVID, should you still get the vaccine? Well, for the same reason, you know, because COVID comes as a spectrum and you may not generate the type of antibodies with natural disease that you need in terms of predictable protection for the future. So that's why getting the vaccine in addition to that is helpful. Now, of course, these are messages that have been circulating for now, you know, many couple years at least at this point.
Yeah.
But yet, I think there are people that still haven't come to terms with this.
We'll take out. We can continue that conversation and a whole lot more with our guest today, Dr. Nasia Safdar, professor of medicine at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, and then we will be back. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mehler here talking about the Omicron variant and how effective COVID-19 vaccines are against the virus. Our guest is Dr. Nasia Safdar. She is a professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, a member of an infection control department at UW-Madison. And of course, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about the newest corona variant called Omicron? Have you gotten your booster shot? Call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And, man, we can start back up with another call. Peter in Pewaukee, thank you for joining us. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Larry and Dr. Safdar. My daughter, 3 weeks ago, she is fully vaccinated and boosted, but she did come down with the virus. Stayed away from people for 10 days, and now is back out in doing her job and basically back in the community. I haven't seen her since that happened. But Saturday, she plans on coming over to my house. Do I, or does anyone, I'm assuming that she has some form and some level of immunity because she got the virus. Does anyone, or does she have to be concerned about meeting other people in the community, in the public?
And spreading the virus, in other words, could she spread the virus to somebody else after this?
You know, I would say it's very unlikely because we know that the way the virus dynamics work with SARS-CoV-2 is that you're at highest risk of transmitting to other people a couple days before you get symptoms or test positive, and then 2 to 3 days right after. So after that, there's a sharp decline in the amount of virus that is in your nose that you can, you know, theoretically transmit to other people. So at day 10, I would say that she's pretty safe in terms of her risk to others.
All right, Peter. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Someone wondered, where can people get a COVID-19 pill? We were talking about those pills earlier.
The antivirals?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there is, you know, supply is not where it should be either of those, really. But generally, from healthcare systems is where, or pharmacies is where you would get them. They are prescriptions, so someone would need to have a prescription for them.
Yeah, and taking the pill doesn't mean you don't need, or let me put it this way to make it easier. Does taking a pill mean a person doesn't need a COVID vaccine?
No, because the pill is really for when you get COVID. You know, it doesn't have any preventive benefit. So once you get COVID, yes, the pill will help many people get protected against
severe illness and hospitalizations and so on. But it doesn't have the same long-term protection that, you know, an upstream vaccine does.
Okay. Mona in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, thank you, Larry. Well, I'm one of those orphans that got a J&J to start with, and then I got a Moderna booster this fall. And I just don't feel I've got the same protection as someone who had two mRNA vaccines and then a mRNA booster. And I'm just real concerned about the coverage I'm getting. And then I also just heard today that there's another Omicron variant out.
Stealth,
in the UK. I think there's a couple cases here, and I want to know more about that.
Yeah, so the new variant, you know, what some are calling the stealth variant, is sort of a mini version of Omicron in some respects. I don't think we know anything more about it besides that it's emerging and it's there. I would be very surprised, and of course people have been wrong about many things about the pandemic, but everything at this point points to that whatever vaccine people got, especially if they were boosted, the effect against Omicron is pretty strong and pretty persistent. And I think the same is likely to be true for this stealth vaccine as well. You know, if we had nothing but the Janssen vaccine, we would still be very happy with it because the efficacy of it is upwards of 70 to 80% in the vast majority of instances. And with the booster, even if there's decay, you get back that protection. It is simply because we have this luxury of having other vaccines that then we run into this comparison. But I think the bottom line is any of the three vaccines are far, far better than no vaccine. And the difference between the mRNA and the Janssen is not as meaningful once you get the booster with the mRNA.
Thank you very much, Mona, again for your question. Pat in Kewaunee will give you a chance. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I have a question about going to the dentist during COVID. I understand dentists don't have to tell you if they're vaccinated or not because it's protected under HIPAA. And I understand that my dentist office is taking all necessary precautions with PPE, double masking, air system, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that they're not able to tell me that they're vaccinated or not kind of gives me cause for concern. What do you think about that?
I think, you know, you're right that they don't have to disclose their vaccination status. Many people choose to do so because it reassures others, but they don't have to. So I think what we're left with then is taking a look at their COVID protocols and seeing whether they are adequate to protect against transmission that's inadvertent. Now, all healthcare systems of any type should have a symptom screening and monitoring program so that there should never be any employees with a respiratory illness that, you know, are actively coughing and so on, or be sick at work. So that's one thing. And then the other is, you know, the things you describe, I would think, would be very protective against transmission. So it's not 100%, I would say. I think we would all feel better if we knew about vaccination status, but that doesn't seem likely that that's going to be a requirement, the disclosure of it, I mean.
And I imagine dental offices can advertise that their people are vaccinated, too. There would be nothing to stop them from doing that, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think people should proclaim that because it helps reassure others.
Yeah, absolutely. Pat, thank you. And I guess you could, you're sitting there, you could ask the person, and they could say yes, or they could say, well, we're not really allowed to, we don't have to say that, and you can draw your own conclusions. A listener sent us an email. They say, human DNA is consistent, doesn't usually change much after conception. Virus RNA can change each time cells replicate. Though anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers might have successfully resistant variants, how likely will their luck continue? And since variants have different versions, can those versions happen in different locations without people traveling?
I think, you know, it's a complicated question. I think the bottom line is that the way viruses evolve is that they mutate. And they mutate constantly in the background. We don't really care about those mutations unless they affect how they are transmitted or how they cause the disease they cause. So having said that, with this particular SARS-CoV-2, you know, there have been literally thousands of mutants, and there are some variants that have now raised concern.
So, yes, I think that process is likely to continue. I think what vaccines do, they blunt the effect of these variants on the human, so they become less relevant in terms of the illness that they cause. But as long as there's circulating virus, it will continue to do what it's designed to do, which is to produce variants.
Roseanne sent us an email saying that their brother is not vaccinated against COVID and had COVID early on. He still doesn't have his taste or smell yet after all these months. He is afraid of the shot because the last two times he got the flu shot, he got sick for 2 weeks. Is there a connection between flu shots and COVID shots, and what should Roseanne tell him?
Yes, you know, it's a complex question. I'm certainly sorry to hear that the sense of smell and taste, which can be a really profound life-changing experience for people, and that hasn't come back. Eventually, I would expect that it would. You know, in a minority of people, it does take months and months to return, which can be very distressing. But I think the answer to the question is that, yes, you should absolutely get the vaccine. The flu and the COVID-19 vaccines are not really related in any way other than that they're both vaccines directed towards viruses, but completely different viruses. And you can get reinfected with COVID, so the vaccine would be useful for him for that purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And we haven't heard the reaction to the COVID shots has been maybe a sore arm or something. I don't think there have been really very many bad reactions, have there?
Well, people can sometimes feel sick for, you know, about a day to a couple of days, and that can be manifest as body aches and fever. It can be a bit more profound than what you get with the flu vaccine. But, you know, it's a couple of days of feeling poorly compared with if you get COVID, weeks and weeks of major illness. So I think the decision is easy to make if you think about it that way.
Yeah. You can join in, by the way. Call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Back to those antiviral pills for a minute. Are they similar or different from Tamiflu, which is an antiviral medication to prevent serious flu symptoms?
They are different. I mean, these are particularly directed against SARS-CoV-2. They also have benefit for other types of viruses down the road, potentially. But these two are for the moment, you know, the studies and all the efficacy work that has been done has been directed against SARS-CoV-2. Tamiflu is very specific for the influenza virus, so it would have no activity against SARS-CoV-2.
And the CDC says if you're exposed to COVID-19 that a person should quarantine at least 5 days. We've heard people calling saying they had people quarantining for 10 days. But is 5 days long enough?
So I think, you know, it's all a series of trade-offs at this point. We know that there is, like in many things, you know, there's a spectrum. There are some people that will shed virus for a few days, and there are some that will shed it for longer. And there's no easy way to determine in which category you will fall. Let's say you get COVID-19 or are exposed to it and start getting symptoms. So from that perspective, you know, 10 is probably better than 5 because you take into account those people that might be shedding for longer. But on average, for the majority of people, I think 5 plus a mask after is likely to be okay.
Okay. And, yeah, that makes sense to me for sure. So Jason in Cudahy, maybe we'll go to you next. Jason, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I had a question. I was wondering if getting COVID can cause any kind of heart issues. My brother was diagnosed with COVID maybe about a year ago, and then this past February died of a heart attack, and he was, you know, very young. And I'm just kind of, you know, and then I have another friend who just recently got COVID, and then now he's has issues with hypertension, and I don't know, I'm just kind of curious if there's any kind of correlation to getting COVID and having, like, you know,
yeah,
heart problems.
Yeah, sorry for your loss, Jason, for sure. Dr. Safdar, you comment?
Yes, so, you know, just like other viruses, virus that causes COVID-19 can also cause an inflammation of the heart called myocarditis. Now, many people will not even know that they have myocarditis, and they will recover quickly. But there is a spectrum there, too, and sometimes people can get very sick from it. Now, it would be hard for me to think that somebody would have, you know, they get COVID and they fully recover and then pass away due to a heart-related condition, for that to be connected to the initial infection. But certainly, if you get COVID-19, there are all kinds of heart-related inflammation that is a part of this infection as well. We think of it as, you know, we've been talking about it as a predominantly respiratory infection, but really it's a whole body attack.
Yeah. Jason, again, sorry for your loss, and thank you for calling. We'll take another call. Henry in Bayfield, your turn. Hi, Henry.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment about the impacts on society at large and on families from two personal experiences. We're in the process of moving from Oak Creek to Bayfield. And in Oak Creek, I had a blood clot develop in my leg, and I ended up being hospitalized, but the nearest hospital with a bed available was two counties away. And along the way, the two MTs were talking about, well, yeah, that hospital's full COVID. That hospital's full COVID from Oak Creek up to... Well, we went clear to two counties away.
So
there's an impact on the healthcare system for everybody else that may suffer anything from a blood clot to a traffic accident.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that, Henry. Comment, Dr. Savdar?
I think that is such an important point that you raise. You know, we don't want to lose sight of all the other things that we can be exposed to, trauma, heart disease, cancer, and so on. Focusing on COVID to the exclusion of all else will doubtless be problematic. But it is true that health systems are completely at capacity and stretched to the max with the COVID-19 patients that are coming in that desperately need medical care.
And for those like Henry who need other kinds of care, if they can't get in anywhere, that's a terrible thing.
That can have really bad consequences.
Yeah, and it's something for, I think, people to think about when they're thinking, you know, you can think about yourself sometimes, but you need to think, I think Henry's getting at, you need to think about society as a whole, and if you're not vaccinated, for example, you're more likely to wind up in the hospital, and that could affect your own family members or other people's family members.
That's right. I mean, we never want to put healthcare systems in a place where one has to decide between the type of care that can be given. But sometimes there's no choice, you know, there's no staffing, no physical space. Well, what is one to do?
Thanks again for calling. Brandon in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Brandon.
Hi. I was just wondering about if a person is vaccinated, you know, they can still catch COVID and they could still spread COVID. So, like, going back to, like, a previous caller, why would I care if, like, my dentist was vaccinated or not? If vaccinated people can still spread COVID even if they're asymptomatic? What difference would that make if, you know, my dentist or friend is vaccinated or not? Couldn't they still give me COVID?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it is true that if someone is vaccinated, you can still get breakthrough infections and you can still shed the virus. But the duration and the extent of shedding is different in people who are unvaccinated versus those who are vaccinated. And that probably has to do with the fact that if you are unvaccinated, you're much more likely to get sicker from the virus. So your cough might be more profound. You might be... you know, transmitting larger amounts of virus for longer periods of time. So from that standpoint, it is important to know whether one is vaccinated or not.
There you go, Brandon. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I think it was on Tuesday, Pfizer and BioNTech announced that they've started a clinical trial for an Omicron-specific COVID-19 vaccine. What do you hope comes from that study?
Well, I think that
hopefully they will find that it works very well against Omicron. And I think the group that might have the most need for something like that would be people who are immunocompromised, where the existing vaccines, you know, while they're very effective, might not have as good a response in that group.
Yeah. And the CDC is recommending kids aged 5 years and older get the vaccine. What role do you think the K-12 schools play in transmission rates?
Well, I think, you know, anytime people are gathering together, I think it's an opportunity for viral transmission. We know that in respiratory virus season, for instance, a lot of kids will get respiratory viruses from each other, and I don't think SARS-CoV-2 is necessarily any exception. But I also don't think that this setting in particular should be singled out as one that is very high risk for transmission, because we just haven't seen that when the right mitigation protocols are put into place, like the masking and the vaccination and, you know, all the things that testing, for instance, of the schools are doing. I think it really comes to a trade-off, you know. Nothing is more important than children's and children's education, and we know that remote learning is not really education. I'm sure, you know, people feel that the knowledge is being transmitted, but at the other end, it's really crickets. Children just don't absorb anything remotely as well as they do in person. So for all those reasons, it's a risk that we should be willing to take, provided that we do all the mitigation measures that schools are already doing, and if they aren't, they should be.
How accurate are the at-home COVID tests, by the way?
The at-home COVID tests are a useful adjunct to have. They are not as sensitive as the PCR, meaning that if you have symptoms of SARS-CoV-2 and the antigen test is negative, you still very well could have it, and you should follow it up with a PCR. But if you have symptoms and the antigen test is positive, you can be reasonably sure that that's the diagnosis. So, you know, if someone is feeling poorly and you have an at-home antigen test, it is such a convenient way to make the diagnosis without having to go out and leaving the comfort of your home and so on. So I do recommend that people have it and keep it handy.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've had a couple of tests all that way myself, and of course I've had lab tests as well over time, and it is kind of nice to have at least, you know, I certainly wasn't feeling bad or anything, but I took the test anyway, and I tested negative, so I kind of felt good about that. Well, this has been really great talking with you today, Dr. Safdar. Thank you so much, and I hope we have a chance to do this again, maybe down the road. Thank you again. Very much appreciated.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Dr. Nasiya Safdar is a professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, a member of an infection control department at UW Health. Our guest today. It was great to have her with us, and we hopefully we'll get her back down the road. Just looking ahead, tomorrow it's Garden Talk. You love orchids? Those beautiful exotic plants can come in all shapes, sizes, and colors, and we'll have an expert from the Orchid Growers Guild in Madison to tell us what an orchid needs to thrive and bloom. But in the meantime, hey, stay with us. There's lots more in store on the Ideas Network right through the afternoon. I'm Larry Mealer.